a latest episode of the University Radius Trials Talking About Stuff podcast finds me talking to Richard Taylor, who's Chief Operating Officer at Loughborough University. Like quite a few others in similar positions, Richard's taste for higher education management started with a stint as a sabbatical officer at Durham University, before landing an exams administration job at Loughborough, and then returning north, becoming in due course head of marketing back at Durham. From there, it was another trip back to the East Midlands, where in 2003, Richard was appointed as Director of Marketing at the University of Leicester at a very young age. Working with Bob Burgess, he grew his portfolio, eventually ending up as Deputy Registrar, before landing the job of COO at neighbouring Loughborough, where he's now been for almost a decade. We discuss the distinctive profile of Loughborough University in terms of its sporting environment and activities, student experience and research specialisms. The university has a really strong sense of community, belonging and sense of purpose, which enhances both student satisfaction and town-gown relations. Looking at the broader higher education landscape, Richard observes that it is the sheer breadth of the range of challenges faced by the sector, from industrial relations to regulatory compliance, which makes things so very difficult at present, as well as noting that we often make things harder for ourselves by our cautious approach to embracing risk. Of course, we couldn't let this conversation end without discussing Richard's role in supporting the operation, which led to the discovery of the remains of King Richard III in a Leicester car park. This was a remarkable example of academics and amateur historians working together on what turned out to be an internationally noteworthy find, which, as Richard observes, speaks to something bigger about the role of universities and their research in society. Finally, Richard reflects somewhat ruefully on Sayers' Law and the efforts invested in low-stakes activities and unnecessary battles in university. It's a really good conversation and well worth a listen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Richard Taylor, who is Chief Operating Officer at Loughborough University. Welcome, Richard.
Hey, hi, Paul.
It's really great to have you on. So you've been around for a while, not quite as long as some of us, but you've been around for a while. But and you've been at Loughborough for a while. But let's see, how did you end up as CEO at Loughborough? Because you started out, I think, as a sabbatical, as quite a few people who are CEOs now have done.
Yeah, no, I started off many years ago as student union president at Durham, which was fantastic, great fun for a year. But at the end of it, you kind of think, well, what the heck am I going to do now? I quite like universities and maybe haven't got the patience to be an academic and do a PhD. So I'd quite like to work in a university. But what do you do? Because at that time, as you will know, the existence of sort of graduate entry schemes for university administrators were sort of non-existent. So I managed to get my toe in the door, actually here at Loughborough in the mid-90s in a maternity cover role in the exams office. And it was a bit boring, but especially after being student union president. But,
yes.
You kind of cut your teeth on good old working in an academic registry for a year. After that, I moved into schools liaison and student recruitment at what was University College Stockton, on there to University of Durham, becoming eventually its head of marketing in the late 90s. And then moved to the University of Leicester in 2003 to be their director of marketing at the ridiculously young age of 29 at the time.
Ooh. Then was your first degree in any way connected with marketing then?
Absolutely, politics, absolutely connected to marketing. The way that you communicate, the way you try and persuade people of things, that there were very significant similarities.
Yeah, okay, I get that. So you plan this marketing for, and then end up at Leicester as director of marketing, as you say, at a very young age. So Leicester then, I mean, it was, I mean, so that was a wee while back now. So and.
you know, was Leicester, you know, kind of really, really coming up with creative approaches to marketing? I mean, was that why they took you on?
So my predecessor had very sadly passed away quite suddenly after a short illness. So the organisation was sort of shell-shocked as a consequence of that. So there I was, 29, going into this setup. I mean, the team was very, very small. I mean, there was three or four people at the time. So, you know, I had to build a team. I had to bring people in. Bob Burgess, the late fantastic Sir Bob Burgess, was VC at the time. He was ambitious for the university, a thoroughly decent man, very much supported me. And I began to build a strong team, including a young Helen Pennack, who joined my team. Someone you'll know there, Paul.
Indeed.
You know, that was interesting. Leicester had its challenges. It was outside of the Russell Group. It was struggling around student recruitment. It was trying to grow its research base. And marketing was seen as part of the solution to that. And one of the things that I did was I had to make a decision quite early on as to whether I wanted to stay in the sector or whether I wanted to go out and have a broader career in marketing. And I made the decision to stay in the sector. And the way that the team was developed then off the back of that, you know, I picked up things like the planning office, admissions, you know, bits of traditional activity that you would associate with the roles that we do now. And that was really helpful in, again, allowing me to kind of build my portfolio of experiences.
Right. And so having made that conscious decision to stay in the sector, you were then actively, I mean, had you got your mind set on, you know, seeking the registrar role then ultimately, or were you just thinking that you'll see how it goes in a university environment?
Yeah, so I'd never tried to plan more than one or two steps ahead because you kind of fall on your face. But as my career developed, I became interested in the role. And of course, when I'd been at Durham, I'd worked, you know, very closely with John Hayward, who was a fantastic registrar and secretary. And then Dr. John Hogan, who was another fantastic colleague to watch how those people developed their roles. So I always had at the back of my mind that it might be something of interest. And then, you know, the pieces kind of fell into place. You know, ended up here.
So the transition from Leicester to Loughborough then. So how did you end up at Leicester? So you'd accumulated some other stuff. Did you end up in a different position?
Yeah, so I ended up as deputy registrar at Leicester in the end. Right. So I picked up some of the services as Dave Hall developed the team down there, and I was on the, you know, I was on the lookout for a role, and you know, the odd one would come up and you kind of decide. And I did apply for one quite a number of miles away and went through all the agony of, you know, if I got it, would we relocate the family? The children were very young at the time and all of that heartache. Anyway, luckily I didn't get it because a few months later this came up and I sort of fell on my feet by landing this, you know, working with Bob Allison, another Bob, an absolute, you know, fantastic colleague to work with as well.
So you've been there over a decade now, haven't you?
9 years.
Almost a decade. And would you say your job has evolved during that time? I mean, the sector has changed a lot in the past 9 and a bit years. So has your job changed in the role?
Yeah, I mean, you know, our sorts of jobs are always the people who sort stuff out. I mean, I was asked by the sabbaticals to kind of summarise my job and it's sorting stuff out in a strategic way. I think, you know, colleagues listening to this will know full well it's got more intense, it's got more challenging. The compliance arena has intensified. The competitive landscape has intensified. The financial landscape has deteriorated. Industrial relations are a challenge, you know. So you go back 9 and a bit years, and we were coming off the, you know, that period when the higher fees had come through. Quite a bit of that was additional funding, so universities were in a good position. Here we are, nearly 10 years on, with pretty much flat fees over that period. It feels a little bit tighter.
Yeah, no, absolutely does. Can we talk a bit about Loughborough then? Because it is a genuinely distinctive kind of university, isn't it? Right. I mean, you know, it's renowned for sport, but it's also renowned for having a really high quality student experience. And, you know, obviously does extremely well in National Student Survey. But there is a real sense of it being a place that is, offers something distinctive to students. Now, part of that is, I assume, linked in, or you would characterise it as linked in some way to that sporting ethos. But part of it must be not about sport as well. So how do you characterise the institution?
So I think you're right. I think Loughborough does have a very distinctive reputation as a kind of a decaying marketeer. There's something that appeals to me in working for an organisation that's very clear who it is. I think the roots of Loughborough are quite different to many of our peers. The roots are in the making of things, in the learning by doing, history of the organisation, a small technical institute that grew into a college that became a university of technology in the 60s. If you look at Loughborough's portfolio, Loughborough is a top 10 university, but the portfolio of disciplines we deliver is a little bit atypical for some of our peers. So we've got, sports science that we've touched on. We've got, huge amounts of engineering here. We've got very, very large creative arts, very large and successful media studies, big design school. So you can see that history of university, that practical doing of things runs through our portfolio. And then when you can see the university being very much as the birthplace of sports science as an academic discipline, when that starts to come through, you've got that very practical doing combined with sport, which is also quite a practical activity, both the academic and the doing of sport. So you end up with an organization that is very very resilient, very, very, very strong identity, is quite sure of itself, but not in a cocky way, and quite clear about where its strengths are. And that kind of brings us to where we are today. I mean, none of it is without its challenges, but I think the university can tell quite a distinctive narrative about why it's here, how it came to be here, and what its strengths are.
Yeah, I mean, and it is different. So what do the students say? I mean, because you attract obviously a lot of people who come there because they've got the academic qualification, but also your reputation for sporting excellence, right? Does that make a different kind of applicant pool then?
So the university is, you only have to visit the campus to see, the people jogging round. I mean, you don't have to be sporty to be here, but sport.
But it helps.
it's definitely part of who we are. It's definitely part of what attracts the students. So there's some data that says something like 75-80% of our students cite sport as a key factor in choosing the institution, and it makes us distinctive. There are other universities that are good at sport and strong at sport, but there's something very distinctive in the way it pitches into our DNA, But then I think, Paul, it bleeds across into the community and the sense of belonging. And sport is a great thing for the way people belong. That spirit is visible in the volunteering hours that our students do, in the rag that they raise. You will know, and colleagues will know, that academic colleagues, very often their loyalty is very much to their discipline. I think that's just a statement of fact. I think even amongst academic colleagues, though, there's a sense here that there's something, a sense of purpose about the institution that runs through it that does create quite a different feel to some places.
Yeah. What about the the kind of civic dimension of that, you know, because you talk about fundraising and community and volunteering and all the rest of it. I mean, Loughborough is a small place as a location. And do students in the university kind of dominate in the location? I mean, is there a sense in which, you know, there is a kind of town gown divide, or is it all, you know, kind of peace and love and harmony?
Well, it's not peace and love and harmony, Paul. I don't think there's a registrar in the country that would claim that. But, you know, the student population is a big one. You've got 18,000 students here. You've got a town of, what, 30, 40,000 people. I mean, I live in Loughborough. You know, when the students aren't here, it's pretty quiet. So the students are a really important part of the economic performance of the area and the university. With it, I mean, we remark that we are the local authority's biggest and second biggest employer, biggest through the university and second biggest through our science and enterprise park. So the economic role the university plays in the area is large, and I think, you know, all universities, even ones with massively international reputations and reach, play out in the local economy in certain ways, in a positive way. I think because the town is small, we've had to be quite proactive in how we've engaged with our students and with the local authority and other partners like the police. You know, when I was at Leicester, if there was a loud student party, you didn't know whether it was De Montfort or the University of Leicester students who were at it. So you could kind of always shrug your shoulders a little bit. But down here, you know, they're almost certainly our students. So we do get engaged. And, you know, our security team, for example, will respond to incidents in the town. The numbers there for residents to call, that there is a quite an intense level of support that we provide both the local community to help with good relations, but also supporting our students who live out there in the community.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You touched earlier on the, you know, some of the kind of challenges facing our sector now, from, you know, kind of financial to cost of living to industrial action. I mean, it does feel that, you know, universities are under pressure in a way that, you know, perhaps we can't recall it being quite like this. I guess if you know, people like John Hayward were still working in a university, they'd remind you that you know, things used to be tough back in the old days. But it does feel distinctively tough right now. What I mean, as a university, would you say that you're kind of, you know, facing into this? I mean, is there a sense in which you think that you're kind of as prepared as you can be to face these challenges? Because there are many of them, and, you know, it feels that, it can feel a bit overwhelming, can't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, we can recruit students. We performed well in the last ref. We're performing well in rankings. We're financially, you know, doing as well as you can do in this sector at the moment. So the underpinnings of it are pretty sound. And you know, you could be a cynic and say actually the strategy is to not be within the first 50 universities to go out of business, because at that point, you know, someone will have had to have stepped in. And so you could look at it through that lens if you were deeply cynical. But I think we're in a good place. I think we've got a good team, both the academic team and the professional services team, and we spent a lot of time building that team. So I think we're in about as good a place as you can be. I suppose that what worries me a little bit about the landscape is it's not the competition in and of itself. It's not the pressure on the unit of resource in and of itself. It's not the industrial relations landscape in and of itself. It's not the absolutely burgeoning compliance arena in and of itself. It's when you put those things together that it gets really challenging and really complex. I spoke at our audit committee a year or so ago about compliance, and, you know, one of the lay members put a challenge into me saying, well, they worked in the financial services sector, and You know, we didn't know the first about compliance in terms of the burden. And I pushed back a little bit because, you know, whilst I fully accept that the depth of regulation in the financial services sector is very, very deep, when you look at the breadth of the regulatory and compliance activity that surrounds universities, it's absolutely vast. You know, you've got the OFS at the heart of it. You've got, you know, UKVI. You've got, you know, all the duties of care that are around students that's in the news at the moment. But then you're into things like, you know, water hygiene and Legionella in your water system, and you know, all the myriad of things that comes with, yeah, you know, running thousands of student bedrooms. So the complexity is just vast, isn't it?
I completely agree, Richard, and I do think, I mean, because the other thing, you know, your financial services could do, they could just charge a bigger commission, can't they? You know, they can just cover all those additional costs by getting their customers to pay more, and we simply aren't in that position. And you're right, our regulatory regime is multidimensional, you know, because we've got all these things like, yeah, as you say, water hygiene, which are basics, and all the health and safety stuff. But then we've got, you know, things like, you know, ATAS dealing with, you know, particularly sensitive subjects where we're admitting staff and students, and, you know, things around about controlled drugs used in experimental pharmacology, and, you know, all those kind of things, radioactive sources, yeah, you know, control, everything you can conceivably imagine. You know, we've got a finger in that pie, and that creates, I think, a uniquely complicated regulatory landscape. And if that isn't enough, you know, we've got a higher education body shoveling more onto us, and the government coming up with free speech legislation, yeah, and foreign interest registration schemes as well. I mean, in other words, I completely agree. It's a bloody nightmare.
It never stops, does it? There's always a new one, and you know, and then when you try and develop ways of operationalizing this, you know, some of it, you try and keep as much as possible away from academic colleagues and those on the front line, but when you get onto things like trusted research, you've got, yeah, to engage academic colleagues. You can't do it in isolation. So yeah, so the burden is there. And, you know, you see in the UCU dispute concern about workload, and I, you know, I'm not sympathetic to everything UCU says by any stretch, but you know, you can see how some of this stuff, you know, is a concern and really does manifest for colleagues.
I completely agree, and I think that, you know, the one of the common complaints you'll hear across the sector is that workload issue, right? And, you know, and there is a sense, as we were talking earlier, that the kind of level of pressure on institutions is such that the demands placed on every individual working in the university are greater. And, you know, academic colleagues being in the front line of both teaching and research feel that pressure greatly. And then when you layer on that kind of additional regulatory requirement, yeah, it can feel just completely overwhelming. But it's hard to see. I mean, I would dearly love to hack away at that regulatory burden, right? I would do that, you know, tomorrow if I could, but no one's going to let me anywhere near it. But and even the two of us together, Richard, I fear would not make a dent in it. But I think there is a sense in which, notwithstanding that external burden, we do have to try and find ways as a universities ourselves to try and remove some of the internally generated work, you know, because, you know, we're always creating work for ourselves that's completely unnecessary, aren't we? I mean, I don't know how many meetings you have in a typical week, but I'm guessing you don't have a lot of free time.
No, not much. but I think quite a lot of it relates to the way that we conceive risk in the sector. And I think there's a danger when this compliance stuff comes along, that what we do is we insert lots of controls, lots of first line controls into the process, which just slows the process down, takes up resource. And what colleagues do is they try and work around it, if they can't get through it. And so you end up with a system that might be protecting someone's backside, but actually it's pretty dysfunctional from an efficient process design, but also from a compliance perspective. And it's really hard saying to colleagues, actually, I want you to take more risk around some of these issues when this compliance burden is pushing. But actually, if we try and lock everything down with first line checks and controls, we're going to find ourselves, you know, just just immobile.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point. Excellent point. And yeah, we do make life hard for ourselves sometimes. And part of it is about also trusting the professionalism of our staff. I mean, we go out of our way to appoint really good, capable people with degrees, with real, you know, scope to progress, people who are amongst the cleverest you could get, you know, in an institution which is in itself filled with clever people, right? And yet we still, you know, assume that no one can navigate their way through these things without a, you know, 500-page procedural manual, right? Whereas really, we should be trusting the professionalism of our colleagues to do things without someone looking over their shoulder all the time.
And hold colleagues to account if they're reckless, or because you do get people who stick two fingers up at it. Well, let's deal with that. Let's not design a system around that 0.5% that behave in that way. Let's deal with the exceptions in a different way.
Yeah. Talking of exceptionalism, when you were at Leicester, you got involved in something that was, I have to say, you know, unique in the history of university administration, Richard, in that you were involved in the discovery and excavation of Richard III at Leicester in the car park at the cathedral. How was that? How did that feel? That must have been just the most crazy thing that you could imagine being involved in, wasn't it?
It still seems surreal today. It started off as an opportunity to partner with the Richard III Society, Philip Langley, who brought the project to the university. It was a long shot to go and find Richard III. Of course it was, but the university was interested not just because of that, but because here was an opportunity to find more out about the medieval history of that particular precinct, the Grey Friars precinct. And what we had through that project was, you know, really good partnership working until recently with, if I use the word amateurs, and I don't use the word amateurs in a derogatory way, I just use it as a statement of fact, working with the professional archaeologists and osteologists. So you had a really respectful partnership, working its way through there. But you had a really exciting story to tell. Even if Richard III hadn't been found, it was a fascinating story to tell. But, and I will say this to the great credit of my former academic colleagues, you had an academic team who understood the need to tell a story here, to go on a bit of a journey in terms of narrative. So the willingness to speak to the media, to engage with the wider world was there all the way through. So that allowed us not just to have a really fantastic research project, a really fantastic piece of archaeology, but also to tell this story, almost like a Dan Brown novel, the way this medieval friary kind of emerges from this car park. And then you've got the juxtaposition of this, you know, supposedly wronged medieval king juxtaposed with this council car park. So, it had all the elements of a really, really interesting story and a fantastic piece of academic work.
Yeah, I mean, remarkable. And it was genuine international news, wasn't it? I mean, it must have been, felt really that you were at the kind of centre of things then.
So, the day the university's logo ended up on the front page of Columbia's biggest selling daily tabloid was kind of testament to the way this work can reach. I think, and you can look now around, some of the furore that subsequently happened, which some of which is still in train. And it's a little bit sad that it's ended up a little bit where it has. I do think there's some misunderstanding about what the role of a university is in such a project. Universities don't go seeking for the truth. Archaeologists don't go digging for the truth. Historians don't seek the truth. And I think, when you look at the world that we're in with the contentious, unilateral claims that people have got insight into truth and the one true way of considering a particular issue, whether it's Brexit or what's happening in America or the war in Ukraine. I think universities and their methodology and their approach are really part of the solution here. And that's how we come at it. So as I look back over the project, fantastically exciting. Things have gone a little bit awry recently, but a piece of work that I'm thoroughly proud to have been heavily involved in.
Quite right too. And I do think that the reality for all those people reading in Colombia or the US or wherever around the world is actually that that original finding and then announcement, etc., is the thing that sticks with people, right? There's other stuff gone on since, but actually that big news from then is the thing that will be remembered. And I think that's right. But I completely agree with you. I mean, it's challenging for universities to get involved in things that are big and newsy and stuff, particularly where they are nuanced. And, there are different perspectives and, we embrace different perspectives. And that doesn't always suit people who want to have different angles that they want to take, which they then want to involve universities in. So I think it's a really good example of, something that was terrific and a great public engagement thing and a wonderful, interesting historical angle, but also just, shows you how tricky this terrain can be when you get lots of people wanting to come at things from different angles. And it is really difficult.
No, indeed. And now clearly from a university perspective, an academic perspective, there's no way you can rehabilitate someone's character from a skeleton. And that was part of the tension that subsequently ran through the project. Yeah. But, we are where we are. And I agree, it was a great piece of work.
Yeah. Final thing. You've been around in the sector for ages, right? As we mentioned at the beginning, you must have seen beyond Richard III lots of other interesting and amusing or strange things in your time in higher education. Is there one thing that you'd pick out as being particularly unusual or weird or odd that you'd like to share?
So, well, apart from only ever having had a sherry at lunchtime once in my entire career in higher education, so I'll go beyond that, and I want to go back to William Sayers' law, and William Sayers' law says about higher education that the battles are so fierce because the stakes are so low. And I think when we consider our own internal politics, I think that's a really important law to bear in mind, because the battles in our sector amongst colleagues, when you get to the bottom of what people are arguing about, it's silly small stuff. When you juxtapose that with our mission and the work that we do as a sector and the impact that we have on the world, on our young people, on through research and innovation across the globe. What my observation is, some of the arguments we get involved in are pretty bizarre. It's like a Laurie Taylor column all over again. And I suppose that, as I go through my years, Paul, that's the reflection that I have through my career, that God, there's been some silly petty battles along the way that seemed at the time unnecessary and certainly seem now unnecessary. And I think we should never lose sight that our work as a sector is internationally impactful. It has a massive impact on people's lives. And yet sometimes the battles we have with our colleagues are so fierce because the stakes are so low.
I couldn't agree more. And that's a really insightful point, Richard. And I'm sure anyone who's ever got involved in any committee-based discussions around car parking will completely endorse your comments, for sure. But listen, we need to stop there. But thank you so much for your time. Hugely appreciated it. And it's been great chatting.
And you too, Paul. Thank you.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.